ABCs of NMOSD is an education podcast series to share knowledge about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMOSD, a rare relapsing autoimmune disorder that preferentially causes inflammation in the optic nerves and spinal cord. ABCs of NMOSD podcast series is hosted by SRNA, the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and in collaboration with the Sumaira Foundation for NMO and Guthrie Jackson Charitable Foundation. This education series is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics.
Hello and welcome to the ABCs of NMOSD podcast series. Today's podcast is titled All Things Relapses. ABCs of NMOSD is an education podcast series to share knowledge about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. My name is Chrissy Dilger, and I moderated this podcast. This podcast series is hosted by the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association in collaboration with the Sumaira Foundation for NMO and the Guthrie Jackson Charitable Foundation. ABCs of NMOSD is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics. Horizon is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Horizon believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. For today's podcast, we were pleased to be joined by Dr. Hamza Coben. Dr. Coben is an assistant professor of neurology at University of Connecticut in Farmington, Connecticut. He is a neurologist specializing in neuroimmunology disorders, including multiple sclerosis, neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorders, and other rare autoimmune conditions affecting the central nervous system in adults and children. Dr. Coben received his medical degree from Hacettepe University School of Medicine in Ankara, Turkey. After medical school, he did a postdoctoral research fellowship at University of California, Los Angeles, and University of California, San Diego, where he studied neurodegeneration and neuroinflammation in the setting of Alzheimer's disease and HIV-associated dementia. Then, he completed his neurology residency at University of Connecticut in Farmington, Connecticut, and served as chief resident in his last year of residency. After residency, he completed his fellowship training in neuroimmunology at University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Coben's research focuses on the aging and transitional care of neuroinflammatory disorders from pediatrics to adulthood and adulthood to elderly.
So thank you for joining me today. So to begin, can you just explain what a relapse is for someone who is diagnosed with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder?
Of course. First of all, thanks for having me and giving me this opportunity to connect with you and with our patients. Regarding your question, in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, somewhat similar to our multiple sclerosis disorder patients too, the relapse is, first of all, there are a few things to consider before defining a relapse, which is sometimes can be confusing for us as providers as well as for our patients, since we commonly use a couple different terms synonymously. One of them is a relapse, and we also use it an attack or flare-up or exacerbation. These terms are most of the time we use them synonymously. When we try to define a relapse, it's really a new or a worsening symptom, a neurological symptom. This symptom can be a focal symptom affecting only one neurologic system. This could be an eye involvement, as in optic neuritis, and visual change. This could be a weakness or numbness, tingling. This could be affecting only one of these areas, or could be affecting multiple areas at the same time. But most of the time, they are new that our patients did not have before, or they had some symptoms before, but they've gotten significantly worse. Another thing, though, these episodes or symptoms should be happening in the absence of an infection or a fever and should be lasting at least more than 24 hours. That's how we define a relapse or an attack or a flare-up in NMISD.
Okay, great. Thank you. And what is the difference between a relapse, as you just defined it, and a worsening of symptoms? For instance, how can someone who has NMOSD tell which one they're having?
Yeah. In NMOSD, a relapse and a worsening of symptoms can be different. We may mean different things. First of all, there are, as I explained earlier, the relapse, flare, or an attack, it's one aspect in our patients. The other aspect is pseudo relapse, and another phenomena commonly we come across with is Utah's phenomena. Maybe we can explain those first. A relapse, as we discussed earlier, a new symptom that didn't happen before, lasted more than 24 hours in the absence of a fever or any other illness. A pseudo relapse is usually an old symptom that can feel a little worse in the setting of an infection or illness or a stress. This could be a physical stress or emotional stress. But they are old symptoms that they had before, just feeling a little worse. But as long as the illness is resolved and the fever is resolved, those symptoms should go back to baseline. That's pseudo relapse. And another phenomenon we borrow this term from multiple sclerosis literature, which is a similar phenomenon called Utah's phenomenon. In this case, what happens is some old symptoms again comes back or feels slightly worse in the setting of a physical activity or an exertion. For example, one of my patients mentioned that when she was doing some outdoor activities, she was hiking. By the end of the hike, she felt weaker in her legs. But whenever she rested, after 10 minutes or so, when she cooled down, her symptoms resolved. And we call it Utah's phenomena. The other thing is worsening of symptoms can be misleading sometimes and can be confusing. Especially in our multiple sclerosis patients, we talk a lot about progression or secondary progression or primary progression. This phenomenon is not as common in NMOSD. In NMOSD, the progression is usually dependent on the relapses. With every relapse, they may build up symptoms over time. They may progress over time, but only with the relapses. We don't see a progression independent of relapse as much. Still could happen, but much, much rarer. So that part is important. So we don't see that secondary progression as much with NMISD. So if there is a worsening of symptoms, if something is feeling worse, an old symptom, then we should definitely start looking for any underlying infection and fever or any other stressors. Sometimes these stressors can be silent, meaning they may not cause an apparent symptom. For example, one of the common infection is urinary tract infection. Sometimes we don't know about it until we test for it. So those are the important things to think about when we are dealing with a symptom that is feeling worse than usual.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a good explanation. So what is known about the cause of a relapse in NMOSD? Is it possible to pinpoint the cause, or just what is known about it?
So the cause of a relapse is an inflammation of in the central nervous system. And this inflammation even though we don't know that well what triggers that specific inflammation, inflammation nonetheless in the central nervous system affecting the brain, optic nerves, the brainstem portion, and the spinal cord. And this inflammation damaging the myelin and also other supportive structures in the brain and the spinal cord, such as astrocytes, and damaging the blood-brain barrier, and eventually it can be damaging the neurons and axons. And when this happens, it causes new symptom most of the times. And depending on the location, that symptom varies, as in optic neuritis, visual symptoms, as in brainstem, maybe hiccups, or intractable nausea, vomiting, or narcolepsy, excessive sleepiness, or weakness in extremities. This could be, again, focal, with one system is involved, one area of the central nervous system is involved, or can be multiple areas involved at the same time, and they may have both visual symptoms as well as weakness or hiccups at the same time.
Got it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So what should someone do if they think they may be experiencing a relapse?
So in that case, I think it's very important to recognize those symptoms, especially as we discussed earlier, if there's a strong suspicion for a true relapse, a new symptom or a worsening symptom in the absence of infection or illness and lasting more than 24 hours, definitely I would contact my neurologist, their neurologist, right away and seek medical attention, because especially in NMOSD, in aquaporin 4 positive and NMOSD, we know every attack counts and every attack can cause severe and debilitating symptoms. And it's very important to recognize and diagnose early and treat early. And definitely I would seek medical attention right away in that case.
Okay, gotcha. So like possibly an emergency room if needed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Of course, definitely contact the neurologist office first, if possible. If not reachable, going to an emergency room or admitting to the hospital is definitely reasonable.
Okay, thank you. So how, speaking of treatment, how are relapses treated and by what type of medical professional would provide that treatment?
I think at this point, The important thing is it should be treated by an experienced neurologist. The neurologist should be the leading provider, but it requires a multidisciplinary team approach and a comprehensive approach most of the times. And it requires expertise for the most part. And in case of an acute relapse, there has to be an experienced neurologist to make a diagnosis and guide the workup and the treatment afterwards, and an experienced nursing staff. And sometimes the relapses can be severe and can require ICU admissions. And there needs to be an experienced radiologist to read the imaging and give us a better idea about the process. And depending on the treatment that we utilize, the experienced team with those treatment modalities are very important. But the main thing is prompt diagnosis and treatment effectively in a controlled environment in an experienced center.
Okay, great, thank you. And which acute treatments are used in relapses?
In acute treatment, even though it may vary from center to center and depending on the symptom and severity of symptoms, the most of the time our first line therapies after making the diagnosis, right, after making sure this is an acute true relapse, the first line therapies are usually high dose steroids. And depending on the severity and the response, we usually quickly escalate the treatment, especially in the case of aquaporin for NMOSD. It can be slightly different in MOG antibody-related disease. Most of the time, MOG antibody-related disease are very responsive to high-dose steroids, and they recover quickly, and they may not require further treatment. But in aquaporin 4 positive NMO, most of the time we see more severe symptoms and more severe disability and exam findings. For them, most of the time we quickly escalate to plasma exchange right after steroids. Sometimes we do start with steroids and depending on response, move forward with plasma exchange. Sometimes we do it concurrently. And even plasma exchange may not be sufficient in certain cases. And it also requires some time, every other day plasma exchange for about a week or longer. If we don't see a significant response, we sometimes follow a plasma exchange with either IVIG or more immunosuppressive treatments such as rituximab or similar agents. And that's how we treat, at least in our center.
Great, thank you. So how long of a period must pass after a relapse before having another one? For instance, can a person relapse twice within the same week?
It's an important question. Theoretically, I think that we use an arbitrary number as a 30 days. If there is a new symptom or a new attack, new MRI lesion within 30 days, we usually consider that as within the same relapse. Maybe the treatment wasn't as effective, or maybe the treatment was delayed. If it happened in the first 30 days, we consider it as one relapse. If it happened more than 30 days, considered as a separate relapse.
Okay, great. Thank you. So you talked about some of the damaging effects a relapse can have on, for instance, vision or just in general symptoms of NMOSD. Is this damage permanent or is recovery of function possible?
Yeah, again, another very important question. The answer is potentially, and probably more common than other demyelinating disorders such as multiple sclerosis and MOG antibody related disorders in compared to NMO. Most of the time with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, especially the aquaporin 4 positive NMO, the relapses results with or without treatment. Mostly partially, as opposed to in MS, especially earlier ages, they tend to have almost full recovery. Again, in MOG antibody-related disorder, they tend to have almost full recovery. But in aquaporin 4 NMO, it's less common. However, it doesn't mean that that's the rule, especially if we are able to diagnose early enough and treat effectively early enough, we can have great outcomes. There are a couple factors can be contributing that too. In addition to early diagnosis and treatment, maybe a patient's age is an important factor. The younger the patient, the better the response they may get with effective treatment. But still, even our older patients, with effective and prompt diagnosis and treatment, they have better outcomes.
Got it. Thank you. So we talked about acute treatments after a relapse. What are some of the therapies used to prevent relapses for people with NMOSD?
Of course. At this point, I think it's important to understand the disease and the disease course and maybe the natural course. These disorders, NMOSD, neuroendocrine factor positive or MOG antibody positive or double negative NMOSD, they can be slightly different. If we have to start with MOG antibody related disease, it's usually most commonly monophasic disorder, meaning after the first attack, up to 50% of the time we don't see a recurrent or relapsing episodes. For them, after the first event, most of the time after the treatment of the acute attack, we don't usually recommend preventive therapy right away, unless they have another attack down the road. However, in copper for positive NMO and double negative NMO to some extent, we know from natural history studies and experience, they tend to have relapses. And we also know each relapse counts and each relapse may not resolve completely and may cause permanent damage, permanent disability, and it can build up. So for those patients, we most commonly recommend preventive treatment to prevent those attacks, those relapses. For that, thankfully, nowadays we have FDA-approved medications with good effect. But we also utilize in the past, before FDA approval, even now, some off-label treatments. And there are some ongoing studies, and there are novel treatments under investigation. If we have to start with the FDA-approved ones, the first medication which was approved for NMO was eculizumab. It's a complement inhibitor. It's an IV infusion. But one caveat is it has to be infused every 2 weeks. And there are some safety measures that needs to be taken. That's the first medication with good effect and which is approved by FDA. Another medication relatively recently approved is inebilizumab, another infusion therapy. It has a different mechanism of action. It's a monoclonal antibody, targets some compartment of the B cell within the immune system. It's called anti-CD19 therapy. Again, it's an infusion once every 6 months after the initial two doses in the beginning. And lastly, the another medication with different mechanism of action called satralizumab. It's an IL-6 inhibitor, which is the IL-6 shown to be playing a key role in the pathogenesis of NMO, in terms of blood-brain barrier break and also further damage in the astrocytes and myelin. And that medication works that way, inhibiting the IL-6. It's a subcutaneous injection. In addition to these three FDA-approved medications, we utilize some other medications as off-label. One of them, the one common one, is rituximab. It's also an IV treatment, again, has B-cell depleting properties. Instead of CD19, it targets CD20 B-cells. And it's also an infusion every 6 months. And one advantage of rituximab, maybe it's probably more readily available in the acute hospital setting, especially we can utilize in the acute treatment of NMO in the hospital setting. Besides that, there are some relatively older treatments historically used. We still use some sometimes, maybe less so though. Sometimes we use them in combination with other therapies, such as azathioprine is one of them. It's an oral medication taken every day. And another one is mycophenolate mofetil, again, another oral medication with immunosuppressive properties. And rarely, especially maybe not in the United States as much anymore, but in other parts of the world, lower doses of prednisone has been utilized. In addition to that, there are some other medications are under investigation. Some of them completed the clinical trial period with and shown to be effective. One particular one is ravulizumab, which is a second generation complement inhibitor similar to eculizumab, with more extended interval infusions. Instead of 2 weeks, 8 weeks, every 8 weeks infusion. And there are some additional treatments in early stages of investigation. It's a long list, but we're thankful that we have so many options with good effect for NMO patients nowadays.
Yeah, that's so true. And thank you so much for going through each one of those. I know it's a lot, but yeah. Really appreciate it, and I'm sure our community will as well. So talking about therapies, when should someone consider switching therapies? Does a relapse mean their current therapy isn't working, or would you try a little longer? Just curious to hear your thoughts.
Of course, another important question, right? I think at this point, we have to consider a couple things when we come across with this issue. One thing, I think, the timeline of events is important. And another important thing is, even though all of these medications are quite effective, we are still dealing with a significant and relapsing remitting disorder, and which is a chronic disorder. Our ideal goal would be to stop relapses completely with zero relapse, but it may not be the realistic goal at times. We may need to accept some relapses for some patients. But with that, still, it doesn't mean that we don't need to switch, since we have other options. And we try to find the right treatment for the right patient, because it may not work for one treatment may not work for everyone. So with that, one important thing is the timeline, as I mentioned earlier. Especially for some of the medications, we have to look at when the relapse happened, how long after starting the treatment. If it happened very early on, within 3 to 6 months after starting therapy, it may not be considered as a true fail of that particular therapy. Most of these medications takes a while to be fully effective, especially the B-cell therapies. And another thing, especially it was shown with rituximab and in observational studies, even though we don't understand the reason behind it that well, after starting rituximab, within the first 3 months, there was an uptick in recurrence of symptoms or relapses. So sometimes to mitigate that, we may utilize a longer prednisone taper or a concurrent immunosuppressive therapy. But beyond that, beyond 3 to 6 months, we usually see a better effect. So those are the other things to consider. But even with these considerations, if someone is continuing to have relapses, probably it's reasonable to think about switching to another therapy, maybe a different mechanism of action. If you ask how many relapse later you would consider a switch, probably there's not a great answer to that. It probably depends on the comfort level of the neurologist and the patient. Also probably depends on the severity of the symptoms and the attacks. But every attack, every relapse counts, and most of the time we have a low threshold to switch therapies if we have to. But at this point, again, there are other considerations we need to look into, especially around the immunizations, the vaccinations, since some of these treatments, especially complement inhibitors, requires immunization for meningococcal bacteria to prevent meningitis. For example, if we are switching someone from rituximab or inebilizumab to one of these therapies, eculizumab or ravulizumab, we have to think about that because we know vaccine response is attenuated with B-cell therapies. So the timing of the vaccine becomes important, and sometimes we utilize prophylactic antibiotics to some period of time until we are sure they have a good response to vaccine or they're protected for this bacteria. Those are other important considerations during this process of switch.
Got it. Thank you. So we get this question a lot in our community. Are there any non-medication or natural options for helping to prevent a relapse? Would, for instance, immune boosting vitamins help?
That's a great question. I wish I had a better answer, but unfortunately, we don't have great data about other interventions. For example, diet or supplementations and so forth. One caveat with these interventions is very, very difficult to study a diet. And there has been multiple studies ongoing with some good results, but still it's a challenging area to study. But it doesn't mean that we don't have any recommendations based on experience and based common sense. We definitely recommend a healthy and balanced diet. I personally don't recommend any specific particular diet or restrictions, but heart healthy and a balanced diet would be my recommendation. The other thing we know from, again, multiple sclerosis literature more about this is the vitamin D supplementation. I still check for my patients their vitamin D status, and if they're deficient, I recommend supplementing it. And another important consideration is vascular risk factors, such as smoking. Smoking has been shown to be an independent risk factor for MS and progression. It's probably true for NMOSD as well. And since it's also a vascular risk factor, and NMO also to some extent can cause similar problems, I definitely recommend to my patients to stop smoking and try their best to stop. And on top of that, in general common sense and general health considerations, overall well-being in terms of physical health as well as mental health. I think that there are other important areas sometimes we may miss from time constraints, maybe some other reasons, maybe some personal factors, but the mental health, depression and anxiety is very, very common in our patients, which contributes a lot to overall perception of well-being as well as perception of disease, disability. So it's very important to address those issues as well.
Got it. Thank you so much. That's the end of my questions, but I just wanted to open it up to you if there was anything else you'd like to add on the subject of relapses and NMOSD.
Of course. And thank you again for this opportunity. I think we had a great discussion. Beyond our discussion so far, I think I cannot stress enough that it's very important for us as providers and for our patients, recognizing the signs and symptoms of an attack or a relapse in that sense, and taking prompt measures to deal with that is very important. This could be in a patient with a known diagnosis, or this could be someone who's having their first attack. sometimes these symptoms can be ignored and missed, especially this could be from our side, from patient side, because most of our patients are younger and they tend to ignore their symptoms because they're young and they don't expect any major medical problem like that. And on our end, as providers, and if we may miss some of the symptoms, some of the signs. So it's really important for us as a community to educate each other and recognize the early signs and guide the treatment accordingly. And again, another important aspect, as we discussed earlier, especially for our patients, taking care of ourselves as a community, as an individual, in terms of overall well-being, including mental health and physical health. I think those are the other things I want to add.
Great, thank you so much. I think that's all very important. And thank you for spending the time with me today. I know our community will really appreciate this resource.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity. It's been great.